There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box podcast. This is Jenny Kleeman sitting in for Matt Chorley. Today we're looking back at Afghanistan and what's changed for people 4 months on from the evacuation. But first, as ever on a Tuesday, it's Finkelwich, Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich. And we talked about everything from wine and cheese to the Lib Dems.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion. Finkelwich with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
I hope that you two are used to being introduced that way now, because I'm never going to get used to it. But it is, of course, Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's begin with the big story of the weekend. It was bubbling under on Sunday. Baker Dorries WhatsApp expulsion, Nadine Dorries expelled from the WhatsApp group. As in, I want you to let me know, what were the pre-social media equivalents when there were problems like this in the past, in the time of Disraeli? What was the Disraeli equivalent of getting thrown out of a WhatsApp group, Danny?
Well, it's very interesting that we should be on Times Radio discussing this. Before Disraeli, right, in the time of Pitt and Addington, people were paying the Times to attack each other. And you could pay the Times a suppression fee, by the way. So if the Times would come to you with a rumour, and if you wanted to keep the rumour out of the paper, you could pay the Times and the Times wouldn't print it. I always give this as an example when people say the paper isn't quite what it used to be. That is certainly true. Although it's the case that now people have these WhatsApps and Twitter rows and everything, people have always had this sort of row. Disraeli, actually, you mentioned, he had several newspaper ventures which he started in order to maintain his political arguments and have the editorial on his side. So they've always been this kind of attacks on each other in political parties involving whatever is the current kind of media.
David, is it just simply easier to take a screen grab of nowadays?
Well, I was amused when I heard somebody talking, I think it was a comedian saying, can you imagine Churchill doing this to Chamberlain and so on? And it does kind of make you think, if there had been, I don't know, a kind of anti-appeasement Tory backbench group in the 1930s or something like that, and somebody had come on it to defend Ball Stanley Baldwin or later Neville Chamberlain, and then all of a sudden Winston Churchill, one of the acolytes, had suddenly said, oh, I've had enough of this, and it just says Winston Churchill deleted, I don't know, kind of Julian Amory or or whoever it was, etc. Whether you could imagine it doing. But Dan is absolutely right. We've always had equivalents of politicians being cross with it. It's just you didn't really see it in the past. It wasn't. I think the stories your Dan is talking about would have been quite opaque and quite possibly would have been written by somebody called Junius or Caius or something like that.
Some of these people I still don't know who they are, actually, even all this time later. I suppose, David, the equivalent might be diaries. But these didn't come out often. I mean, Chips Channer's diaries are still coming out now, giving us the lowdown on what all the appeasers were saying about the anti-appeasers.
And it's a bit late now, isn't it, really? I mean...
yeah, Doc Cooper's diaries too, so it is a bit late, yes.
That's right. I think after they've died, I think you can honestly say that the immediate political utility has diminished, even if the fascination is still there.
And of course, we know that Nadine Dorries was chucked out of the WhatsApp because she was defending Boris Johnson in light of Lord Frost's resignation. Let's have a little chat about that. Where does Lord Frost derive his sudden political philosophy from, do you think, Daniel?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. It's more David's... David was more puzzled about this than I was. I mean, I know why... There are lots of people who say David Frost was always sort of quite pro-Europe or pro the European Union and sort of became a strong anti-Eurosceptic afterwards. But I've never found that as important as other people do. So a lot of people, for example, this weekend were saying Liz Truss has taken this job and they were retweeting the fact that she was a Remainer. But I don't regard that as being inconsistent. Once you've, it isn't even inconsistent, by the way, to believe as she does that you should have quite a hard Brexit. You can believe that to be consistent with thinking that Brexit isn't a very good idea, but that once we decided to leave, we ought to do that. So I've never had such a problem with the ideological consistency of these people. I mean, obviously, I have some problem with the basic intelligence of the ideas.
It wasn't so much that for me. Dan, Jenny, it was this. In his resignation, which he said had to be brought forward a little bit because the story got into the Mail. What he said effectively was not, I'm going because I can't do the job I was asked to do by you anymore, and without which, if I hadn't agreed to do it, I wouldn't have been in your government, etc., and I wouldn't even have been ennobled to the House of Lords by you, because that's what I was brought in to do. No, I'm resigning because I disagree with all these other big philosophical questions. I think that the Conservative Party should be a low, small government, low tax party. I'm resigning because of that. I think that the government possibly is going too far down the road of net zero on climate change, and I don't agree with that. And I thought, well, who are you to agree or not to agree or to resign on that? But you only brought in because of your kind of belated conversion to the cause of hard Brexit.
I mean, and he's not elected
at all. So now he hangs around the House of Lords. Sorry, Danny, unlike you, because you're hanging around the House of Lords to oppose him. He hangs around the House of Lords telling us all his big opinions about the big questions of the day, and nobody elected him to do it. And that drives me nuts, actually.
That's fair. And by the way, I certainly wouldn't disagree with your basic premise either. But the truth is, actually, his resignation didn't cause the same impact as it would have done if he'd been elected. I was quite interested by that, despite the fact that he's probably more central to Boris Johnson's government than most other ministers. And therefore, his resignation was actually a very big internal deal. But because he wasn't elected, I think not unreasonably, he didn't cause the same... I think it would have caused a bigger ruction if, just to give you an example, Grant Shapps had resigned, not impossible given his position on restrictions. Even though Grant Shapps is nowhere near as central to the government and to Downing Street as David Frost. So I do think I wouldn't quite agree, David. I think there was a reflection in the impact that it made on members of parliament and in the impact that it made in the media of David Frost having not been it was more treated as the resignation of an official than it was the resignation of a cabinet minister. And by the way, there may be a question over whether or not such a person should be in the cabinet. Lots of people believe that unelected people should be in the cabinet. Whether there should be a House of Lords is a different matter, but lots of people think that's a perfectly reasonable democratic model. But if he'd been an official, which he was for a long time, his resignation would have had just the same import.
But the timing of this, of the leaking of the news of this resignation is very interesting. I mean, we had someone on Times Radio Breakfast at the weekend who said that last week was like a hellish advent calendar for Boris Johnson, that behind every every window, another horrific calamity for him to deal with. This was time to hurt, wasn't it, David?
Well, I firstly, just to kind of reiterate the point, who the hell does Lord Frost think he is my kind of my general sort of a point. There's a kind of level of incredible pomposity which is built up to think that actually his opinions on these things should matter in the way he suggests and so on. When it comes to the timing, it didn't look good, did it? I mean, I'm not privy to the kind of gossip about why people time the things in the way they do, or who exactly leaked the story to who with what kind of intention. It said that it was been agreed that he should go round about now, and that the sudden appearance of the story, you have to ask in that case, who appeared the story? Because if it was him, then in that case, it was indeed time to really badly hit Boris Johnson and would indicate some degree of animosity. If it wasn't him, then maybe it doesn't. And Danny may have a view of that.
I don't know whether it was him. It didn't look from the correspondence to me like it was, but it'll have been allies of him, people who know him, people who knew what his intentions were. Exactly how coordinated it is secondary. There is now a strong narrative about the Prime Minister, and every story fits with that. It brings forward the stories that that fit with it that haven't quite happened yet. It amplifies the stories that might otherwise be ignored. His decision to move on wouldn't necessarily have been as important in other circumstances. And so it sort of amplifies the story that Boris Johnson's in trouble.
One of the troubles for Boris Johnson, of course, the North Shropshire by-election, which the Liberal Democrats won with a majority of nearly 6,000 on Friday. And they came out with another one of their kind of classic stunts. It wasn't this time bursting through a blue wall. It was a giant blue balloon. I think that was meant to be Boris's bubble being burst. What did you make of it, David?
Well, the first thing I have to say is, there's a lot about the Liberal Democrats which I could kind of cleave unto politically occasionally, but they always find a way of irritating the living daylights out of me. They are easily one of the most irritating parties on the face of God's earth. I think it's a kind of the terrible mixture of extreme piety and extreme cynicism occasionally about the way in which they go about things. And the thing that irritated me was not even so much their kind of stunt. People do all kinds of stunts, and they're always, as far as I'm concerned, I always hate them, but presumably they do them for a reason. It was their opposition to vaccine passports that really got me last week, because they voted with the Tory rebels again that bit of vaccine passports. They called them COVID ID cards because that was the way they were branding them, and then stated with total clarity that the evidence was that they created a sense of false security. And I asked one of the leading Lib Dems on Twitter to give me the evidence that they had for that contention. And the answer actually turned out they don't have any evidence for that contention, yet they made it. Now, I think that's kind of pretty cynical, but obviously it was something they could say to the voters of North Shropshire and to others, which is, oh, we're not in favour of all these kind of, you know, this particular measure, we're in favour of the others. And I just found it so typical of the way in which they go about things, unfortunately. And I would like them to be better, is what I think about it.
But again, David, don't they have
Danny, Danny worked with them. Danny worked with them when he was at the Social Democratic Party. So I was trying to tease him into being cross about them. Well, sorry, Jenny, I interrupted
you. I was just going to say that don't they have to vote against vaccine passports? Because they're the Liberal Democrats. They're always going to vote against measures like this. What do you make of it, Danny?
That's not necessarily true. So, funnily enough, the problem, David, is you're possibly right. I did, you know, work with the Liberals and didn't always get on so well with that party. But my base rate of crossness is lower than yours. Is the problem? as we've discussed before. So, you know, my view is that I do sometimes find people who say things that I don't agree with quite annoying, and usually then find the way that they say the things that I don't agree with quite annoying as well. But that may just be me rather than them. And I guess with the Liberal Democrats, I always cling to this. In the end, they're at least they're sort of a moderate political party that is trying to, you know, a group of kind of quite well-meaning thing people who want a parliamentary liberal democracy. I find it terribly hard to get that cross with them. Now, listen, I don't agree with their position on vaccine passports. I happen to think the whole existence of the party is a bit of a waste of time, considering we have the Labour Party and they're mostly taking votes away from the party that they intend to be in government with. I can't really understand the point of what they're doing. But I don't find it in myself to get cross. And to take an example, you know, the Conservatives, Boris Johnson ran through a wall of bricks with Brexit written on it. And it was actually quite an effective political stunt. I can't see why I should find the ball more annoying.
Oh, do you know what, Danny? I sometimes feel in our conversations that it's a real shame for the Church of England that you're Jewish. Because if you were in Church of England, you would be a shoo-in for the Archbishop of Canterbury. I swear it.
I want to talk about when is a party not a party, the Downing Street Wine and Cheese Party. Is it a meeting if they're having wine and cheese, if there's nobody taking notes, if there's no laptops, if there is a woman holding a newborn baby there? Is it a work meeting?
Well, I think if they hadn't done any of the other parties, any of the other clear rule breaking, people might have taken a more generous view to what this clearly was, which was a load of people relaxing between their work and the meetings chatting with each other. That's clearly what it was. And they wouldn't have necessarily been keen to badge it as, rule breaking or whatever. But in the light of what has happened, not unreasonably, people are badging it like that. I certainly am. I find it extraordinary, given the given what had already happened to Neil Ferguson, what was about to happen to Dominic Cummings, what happened to Matt Hancock, that these apparently sophisticated political operatives didn't think for a second that to hold a press conference telling people to socially distance and then go to the Downing Street garden and not do that was whatever they decided it was, however they badge it, was, you know, foolish politically and also wrong. Having said all that, personally, I don't think it was a party. It was somewhere halfway between, a social gathering and a work gathering. That's the truth of it. And we all know exactly what it was. We can see it. We all know, if we find the words to describe it, these are people who'd had a press conference, they were working, and they're chatting a combination of kind of cooler gossip and work.
But then they went to have this advertising campaign where they had people on ventilators saying, you know, look her in the eyes completely and say, dead, never bent, right? Bent the rules. I mean, why? What was going on?
It's completely outrageous. And I can't believe they couldn't think of it. I'm just trying to describe the event so that we're all clear what it was. I don't think Downing Street can really object to people calling it a party.
David,
and, you know, in a moral sense, that's what it was.
Final word from you, David.
Half a glass of lager on the table, that's in between meetings. Two bottles of red wine, that's coming pretty close to the party. What I love is the idea that there was somebody with a camera up in number 11 taking photographs.
Yes, that is the real story.
That waits a year and a half to be published. I mean, that's a novel. Right there, that's a bit of a thriller right there. I want to know who did it and how it happened, or, you know, not necessarily names, but just how that took place, and then I want to see it written up.
That was Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich. Up next, Afghanistan.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now it's time for this. No one could forget the images of the Taliban taking over Kabul in August this year and the mass evacuations of civilians which followed, nearly 4 months on from the end of that evacuation. And life for those in Afghanistan looks very different to this time last year. But what about those who were there? Today, we're going to look back on what it was like on the ground when the Taliban swept in. In a moment, we'll hear from the journalists Lynn O'Donnell and Stuart Ramsey. But first, I caught up with Shukriya Barakzai, the former Afghan MP, and asked her what life was like in Afghanistan a year ago today.
Last year, December, this time, I was been thinking about the great year of 2021. Because we had a great hope for the peace process to bring stability for Afghanistan. And of course, I had a great dream because to be seen and to be witnessed the end of pandemic, the COVID-19 catastrophe to be get ended, and lots of other more further plan for 2021. It was a different life. I was in a different city. With different capacity, a different person, I could say.
When did you feel that things were changing in Afghanistan?
I don't know, for some reason, from the very beginning when they announced, when the United States of America signed an agreement with Taliban in Doha, in that was 29 February 2020. That was the time which is I thought something is going wrong, because how possible for a official government to go and sign a kind of agreement with a group which is they were been committed for a large number of terrorist activity, and they was and they are in the list of sanctions by United Nations in other countries. Meanwhile, when the wrong policies from the government of Afghanistan also has been established, they start with a very weak a team for negotiation, and they move on with a different type of messages with the bad ego, where cannot match the ideas of the Afghans. So all those elements made Afghanistan to be in a different way. I was the only one was not been very optimistic about the peace process, but still I try to encourage myself and give the hope that everything will be all right. I'm the only wrong person among other politicians, because the rest of politicians was been extremely supporting that process. And I was the one always say, I wish it could be like that, but according to my knowledge and experience, it wouldn't be like a great and happy ending at the end of that. But it, by one word, you ask about the last December. Last December, at least we had a hope, women were in the offices. Last December, girls was in the office, in the schools and universities. Last offices, December was not such a discrimination, and especially sectarian discrimination, as we are witnessing today. Last December, Afghanistan had a government to be responsible for all those questions internally and internationally, which was been addressed to the government of Afghanistan and to the people of Afghanistan. Last December, people of Afghanistan had great freedom under the name of freedom of expression, equality, and pluralism, different type of political opinion was being raised by different group. So last December, Afghanistan was one of the unique country in being a bridge between South Asia and Central Asia, which is none of our neighbors was enjoyed democracy in entire of their life as much as Afghanistan.
The speed of the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban took everybody by surprise. What was it like for you on the 15th of August? Did it seem like a normal day to you?
Well, I started as a normal day because there was a great messages comes up that Taliban will not enter to, they may not attack in Kabul, but there will be a peace deal. So which kind of peace deal? I believe we had a strong, great reserve number of army, which is they were being well-equipped, well-educated, with a great moral, they will stand. And the Taliban are not the one to confront them easily. But that normal day ended with a very bad nightmare where I was on my normal trip for a medical treatment and checkup, which is suddenly things changed. When I entered the airport, it was Ashraf Ghani's government, where border police, everyone was, and everything was en route. You know, even the PCR test was been necessary before travel. You have to give the PCR test. But when I came out, it was a nightmare. It was the Taliban, like after 36 hours when I get into the airport, I came out with a lot of bad memories, with a lot of shocks, with a lot of traumas, with a very disappointing, with a very feeling of being betrayed by our friends, by our government, and somehow by our soldiers.
You say you feel betrayed. Do you feel that the British government made promises to Afghan people that we couldn't keep?
It's hard for anyone in British to understand. For any Briton, it will be very difficult to understand which shoes we've been wearing in 20 years. Being allies, being a great partner, seeking for the share values among us and Western country, including British. But at the end, opening your eyes and you're alone. And there's nobody there to say, we had shared values, we've been a great partner, we work together, we try to build together Afghanistan and peace and security in the globe. That is, I think, not only my feeling, it's probably every single Afghans, that they work very close with the Western countries for the very democratic values, with a great hope for the brighter future. And we stand for some principles, I feel maybe the same, because that is the most bad feeling ever I had.
And what are you doing with your life now, now that you are no longer an MP, you're no longer in Afghanistan? What is life like for you now?
No matter if I'm MP or not, I'm ambassador or not, I will be human rights and women's rights activist. I will try to play my role in Afghanistan politics. I will try to work and work. No, it's too hard because I have to train myself first, working in a different country under different rules, a different perspective. As a woman with the age of 50, I have to start back everything from scratch when it comes to not the values. I still believe the great values I had, and I will keep and I will try to work for that. But when it comes to work, I should start from scratch. And that shift wouldn't be an easy for me or for anyone, which has been through lots of challenges. And at the end, seeing it's a new beginning with a great question mark, where it will lead us and how it will be. Although I'm grateful to the people of Britain and their government, they opened their heart to us. But it is a great challenge for us, for people like me in particular.
And you're in touch with people who are still in Afghanistan. What do they need now?
Humanitarian crisis. like the first immediate thing is right now to reach them by all means to help them. Food crisis, lack of medication is there. Lack of safety is there. And most of them are facing life threat and their life in danger. And I think two things should go parallel. The evacuation process, or probably three, evacuation, reaching by humanitarian aids to the people of Afghanistan, and by political pressure, starting a new chapter for Afghanistan, that to hold Taliban to be accountable for their action.
Does that mean talking to the Taliban, though? You say we should use all means. Should we be talking to the Taliban and working with them?
Certain label, if we like them or not, they are elephant in the room. We cannot deny, unfortunately. So this is important and very, very important to hold Taliban to be accountable for their action. And this is definitely need and require talks, but not legitimacy, not to be recognized. I'm not talking to recognition for the Taliban. I'm saying to be engaged and hold them accountable and to be talked with them, yeah.
That was Shukriya Barakzai, the former Afghan MP. We are looking back at the fall of Afghanistan 4 months on. I'm joined now by Lynn O'Donnell, a journalist and part of the War Studies Department at King's College London, and by Stuart Ramsey from Sky News. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Lynn, if I could begin with you, when did it become clear to you that the Taliban was taking over?
Well, I think what Shukriya said about the Trump-Taliban deal that was signed on the 29th of February last year was really that really sealed it for me. He essentially handed victory to the Taliban. I went back to Afghanistan in May this year, and I spent the last 3 months of the war fighting. I went to covering the end of the war. I went to a lot of places across the country, reported from front lines in various places, and it was really very clear that the Taliban had a very well thought out strategy, and that they were acquitting it and taking over in a very stealthy and strategic manner, and that the onslaught was going to lead to an inevitable takeover. I think really anyone who didn't understand that just wasn't paying attention.
And yet when the takeover happened, it felt unexpected. Nobody expected it really to happen quite so soon, did they, Lynn?
Well, maybe not quite so soon, but there were certainly evacuation efforts going on for months. The Americans started their evacuation of personnel from their embassy in May, June. American visa and passport holders who were Afghan nationals were also being evacuated for a couple of months before the August 15 fall. The French did it very methodically. The Germans did it very methodically. The Brits didn't do it very well. It was almost like it came as a surprise, and we know that there was a lot of delusion and denial going on at the upper echelons of the MOD and the FCDO in London. But yeah, the writing was on the wall very early, and there really aren't any excuses for saying we didn't think it was going to happen. That it happened on August 15, okay, maybe the date was a surprise, but it was only ever going to be a matter of weeks anyway.
Is that something you'd agree with, Stuart, that the writing was on the wall?
Yes, I mean, we were watching cities falling, and we were seeing the military literally just handing over their positions. And I think that was one of the things that struck me. It made me write to my bosses saying that we needed to go earlier than we were previously planned. Remember, everyone was preparing for 9/11 anniversary, so that a lot of the news organisations were thinking about that. But it was quite clear that it was moving much more quickly, and that any type of evacuation effort was going to come under pressure as they started falling. And I think, for the Taliban, their masterstroke in many ways was surrounding police stations and army barracks, and telling the police, for example, that if they left or if they handed over their weapons, they could leave. Many had held on because they thought they'd be killed, of course, and some were, of course. But by doing that and letting these guys go back to their homes, So then the momentum just got going and quicker and quicker. And of course, the evacuation effort was sort of predicated on the fact that Kabul wouldn't fall itself, that it would hold perhaps to the end of the year. But obviously, as soon as the military and the police had left their posts, it was inevitable. It was just a matter of which of the days they were going to come in, because we could see them coming. I mean, we were getting the reports that they were literally down the road, and we were only a few miles away from them. So it was, by that stage, absolutely inevitable.
And both of you would have been faced with a decision then at that point on the 15th of August, and a difficult one, because if you're a journalist that's used to operating in hostile environments, you want to be where the action is, but then you had to decide whether or not you should stay or go. Stuart, were you torn?
We did want to stay. We weren't. I mean, actually, the decision was made was in many ways made for us, because the takeover was so fast right at the end. So if you had any sort of dithering, it was already too late. People were leaving, but it was very difficult to get onto flights by that stage. We thought about it, but actually, to be honest, I've been covering Afghanistan since 9/11, and it felt that, and I've met the Taliban on a number of occasions, we decided to take the view that we would stay whatever, and yes, it was a bit worrying for me and the rest of my team and colleagues, and many of whom I know very well, but it was sort of, that is what we are paid to do, and as dangerous it might be, that is what we do. And so yes, it wasn't much of a discussion. It was just a sort of like, okay, this could be very unpleasant, but we've sort of got no choice, we're here now.
And Lynn, how was it for you? Did you hesitate over the decision of whether to stay or leave?
No, Jenny, I was in Herat, the western city, with my friend and colleague, the Afghan Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Masood Hosseini. We went there in the first week of August, and we had planned to go for 2 days. We were trapped in the city for 5 days. We watched the Taliban entering the city. We saw militia who were working with the secrets of the intelligence service, military guys, beating Taliban to death. We saw people take to their rooftops and call Allahu Akbar, trying to retake and reclaim their religion that the Taliban fought in the name of. And Masood had a visa for the Netherlands as his plan B. And we sat in our hotel watching through big windows overlooking the city, watching it all fall apart. And I said to him, you know, it's once Herat is gone, Kabul is only days behind. You have to make a decision. So we went back to Kabul, and I changed my ticket to the same day that Masood did, which had to be 2 weeks before his Dutch visa expired, and it happened to be August the 15th. And so we went back. So anyway, we went to the Turkish Airlines office and bought and organised our tickets. A couple of days later, Masood went back there with a friend of his who also needed to get out. And there were 1,000 people cramming the airline ticket office. And so we knew, and very, very many people knew, that it was all coming to an end. But we were, coincidentally, as it turned out, our timing was perfect, because Masood has a target on his back. The Taliban told me they'd put a target on my back. We were high-value targets. And every day when I was working with Masood, I got into the passenger side of his car and saw the bullet holes from the last time he'd been ambushed in Kabul. And so we knew that we were in a lot of danger if we stayed. And we were on the last commercial flight to lift off, wheels up at 10 past nine on the morning of the 15th of August.
So you were very lucky, Lynn.
Is there
a feeling of guilt that comes with that luck? Because there are a lot of people who weren't as fortunate.
I don't think that I need to feel guilty. I feel very concerned. I feel I have hundreds and hundreds of people contacting me all the time. Every day my inboxes fill up. Can you please help us get out? And there are a lot of people who are in very grave danger, who are being hunted down. People are being killed. There are bodies being hung from trees. Children go out in the morning and see headless bodies in the streets. Afghanistan under the Taliban has has become a dystopian horror for the people who are still there beyond our imagining. Do I feel guilty? No, I don't. I think the guilt should lie with the Foreign Office, the people whose job it is to issue visas, the people who told Afghans for 20 years, the British government, all the NATO governments, the United States, we will never abandon you. And then they did. That's where the guilt lies, not with me. I'm a correspondent. Mm. I'm a reporter. I did my job.
I mean, Stuart, are you hearing that from people in Afghanistan? We heard from Shukriya Barakzai just before, where she was talking about that sense of betrayal. We made a lot of promises. In the UK, we made a lot of promises. People built their lives and got an education on the basis of the promises that we made to them. And do people feel that we have let them down terribly?
Yeah, I think they feel absolutely let down. A lot of the news organisations, the Times amongst them, if I recall, and the Guardian, Sky, ITN, did approach the government saying, you know, there has to be a special visa programme to allow all the people that have helped us over the years, that have got in, helped us translate and to also produce and to fix for us in very, very testing circumstances, to be included into the sort of evacuation programme, and to go alongside the people who had worked for the British military and for the government and for the rest of the coalition forces. We were successful, as were the others, in getting some, if not all of them, out. But we're talking very, very small numbers, relatively speaking. I think the British government had underestimated the sheer volume, the sheer numbers of people that they actually had a responsibility to. And it's not just those who had worked for them, but it's also their immediate families. Mm. Because as Lynn is saying, people are being targeted. Whatever the Taliban said at the beginning, and there were some frankly nonsensical remarks made by politicians around the world and military commanders that perhaps the Taliban were going to be reasonable as sort of a Taliban 2.0. Well, I never thought that was going to be the case. And much more importantly, nor did the people who worked for us and with us, and many of those who worked for the coalition forces and the government. And so that's exactly what we're hearing is happening now. We know from our friends there that, you know, life is very difficult. The women's issue is a massive one. I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people miss out on. We knew that the Taliban were going to be difficult to for women, but I'm not sure that people actually realise just how fundamentally life has changed for them. We know about the education, we know about the control on the jobs, but it's dangerous as well. And you add that to the insecurity, the effect of the famine, all made worse by the weather, the fact that obviously billions of dollars of aid aren't being released to the Taliban. There has to be some type of coordinated negotiation with the Taliban so that some assistance from the aid agencies in particular, but overseen probably by the United Nations, can get into the country, because we are looking at an absolute disaster there. But to go back to the central point, yes, huge numbers of people feel incredibly let down. And being there just outside the airport, watching these tens of thousands of people pleading to get on board planes, terrible pictures we saw of people getting onto them and falling off from the outside, all of those things. And then ultimately standing in sewage ditches, trying to get across the sewage ditch to the soldiers. And then, of course, in that very same ditch, a suicide bomber killed an awful lot of people who had just been there for days trying and pleading, many with legitimate paperwork and passports that gave them the right to get in. But because of the chaos, they simply couldn't get processed. And I think that was something, well, I'll never forget it. It was genuinely horrendous.
I mean, Stuart, you say you have been reporting from Afghanistan since 9/11. And of course, you know, it may have begun to seem inevitable that the Taliban were going to take over at some point. But in those 20 years that British troops were in the country, there was a point where it was unthinkable that the Taliban would return, that all of this would be for nothing. I mean, I reported from Afghanistan in 2012, and the idea that then the country would be going back, it really was unthinkable, wasn't it?
It was unthinkable if the circumstances changed, remained the same. Yeah. Because Donald Trump basically said the Taliban had won and did a deal so that his troops weren't attacked, and he gave them a date by which he would leave. Joe Biden brought that date forward. And so if you combine that with the mentors, that's the basically the advisors, both British and American and other countries who were there, who helped helped the Afghan army. And then much more importantly, the technical support staff that kept helicopters and planes in the air were effectively withdrawn as well. So you had this large army, very well equipped, but slowly but surely was losing command and control structures and also the wherewithal for their helicopters, which pretty much can secure anywhere against the Taliban, suddenly stopped flying. So it all just got worse. And as a result, all of those conditions changed so fundamentally that it almost became inevitable that the Taliban would take over. And as we say, this had been growing for a while. It wasn't like this came as a complete surprise, although sometimes you did seem to think that particularly the British did come as a complete surprise. But the indicators have been there for a while. We're not talking days, we're talking months and months and months.
That's all we've got time for on the Red Box podcast. Thank you for listening. Matt will resume normal service tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.